HYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shafiq Gabra and Tagreed Al-Qudsi Gabra were professors at the University of Kuwait when Iraq invaded their country. The Iraqis took over the university and expected the professors to keep teaching. On today's Fresh Air, the Gabras share stories of the invasion and the resistance. Tom Friedman has reported from Lebanon and Israel for the New York Times and is the author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. Coming up, we talk with Friedman about covering the politics of the war from Washington, D.C. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq said today that captured Allied prisoners of war will be treated as war criminals. The British Broadcasting Corporation quoted Iraqi radio as saying that Allied fighters had committed war crimes by killing innocent civilians with machine guns. The broadcast also said that Allied leaders, such as President Bush and British Prime Minister John Major, should be tried for war crimes. Allied coalition leaders have accused Iraq of violating the Geneva Conventions by displaying Allied POWs on television and using them as human shields at potential military targets. The French government has given permission to Britain to let U.S. B-52 bombers based in the British Isles fly over French territory to the Gulf. The planes will be used in bombing raids against Iraq and Kuwait. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French government, Louis de Ponsec, said temporary authorization had been granted under certain conditions, which he said would be made public soon. He said the restrictions concern the type of weapons used in the bombing of civilians. Press reports say the French had not given Britain automatic permission to overfly its territory because it wanted assurances that the planes would not be used to attack civilian targets. The B-52 bombers are not precise and are used in carpet bomb attacks. Reports out of London say the government there is irritated that the French hesitated before granting overfly permission. In 1986, France refused authorization for U.S. warplanes in Britain to fly over France on their way to a bombing raid against Libya. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Troops went on patrol in Moscow today as the Kremlin implemented new orders to turn soldiers into domestic crime fighters. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
As promised, the soldiers on patrol today did not use tanks or automatic weapons as they walked beats with regular Moscow policemen. Their job, according to the Kremlin, is to fight rising crime rates all over the Soviet Union. But opponents, including the Moscow City Council, say the presence of troops on Moscow's streets is yet another sign of the Kremlin's drift toward dictatorship. The anti-crime patrols also began today in the Soviet Republic of Lithuania, where 15 people died last month in brutal military attacks on unarmed civilians. The Soviet Interior Minister had promised that no troops would be sent out before consultations with local authorities. But the patrols in Moscow and Lithuania began over the bitter protests of local governments. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points today to close at 2,730.69. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-2 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 247 million shares. This is NPR News. The government reported today that unemployment over the past 7 months has grown at its fastest rate since the last recession. The Labor Department said that unemployment hit 6.2% in January. 1.2 million Americans have been put out of work since June, marking the worst stretch of layoffs and job losses since 1982. January's loss of 232,000 jobs was much bigger than most analysts had expected. Manufacturing and construction were especially hard hit. Some economists have predicted that even if the recession is relatively short, another 1 million Americans could lose their jobs before unemployment peaks later this year. The State Department is welcoming moves by South African President F.W. de Klerk to repeal all remaining apartheid laws and to establish multiracial democracy. George Guetta has more from the State Department.
The State Department called de Klerk's announcement further evidence of his courageous statesmanship. Among other measures, de Klerk called for the repeal of laws requiring the segregation of neighborhoods by race. He also wants to scrap legislation limiting blacks to only 13% of the country's land. Once enacted, the State Department said de Klerk's proposals will abolish the remaining legislative pillars of apartheid. But U.S. sanctions against South Africa will remain on the books until all the country's political prisoners are released, consistent with provisions of U.S. legislation approved 5 years ago. The sanctions bar new U.S. investment in South Africa and the importation of a variety of South African products. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
An informal telephone poll conducted today by ABC News found that more than 80% of the TV viewers who responded didn't think that journalists were doing a fair and responsible job of covering the Gulf War. The network said that more than 62,000 callers responded to a question posed on Good Morning America. A network spokeswoman said 83% of those said they didn't believe the news media were doing a good job. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two professors from Kuwait University who are now living in exile in Virginia. They fear that the story of the Kuwaiti people is being drowned out by the heated discussions of the political issues underlying the war. Shafiq Gabra, Tigrid Al-Qudsi Gabra, and their two daughters escaped from Kuwait at the end of October after living under the Iraqi occupation for 3 months. Shafiq, who is the author of a book on Palestinians in Kuwait, is now teaching political science at William & Mary College. Tigrid has been doing public speaking for the group Citizens for a Free Kuwait. I spoke with them earlier today about their experiences in occupied Kuwait. The Gabras were living in campus housing at the university when the Iraqi army invaded.
That particular campus is on the sea, and it's on the outskirts of Kuwait City, and just adjacent to the port of Kuwait. And it was there where the Iraqis, after they crossed the borders and made it approach the city, that was one of the first places they put their hands on. And it was the shock of our life to realize that the Iraqis were on the main gate with tanks, weapons, hundreds of them over there. It was the shock of our life.
Was there a unified resistance on the university campus after the invasion?
It was summertime, okay, when the Iraqis invaded was August 2nd. There was a summer session. My last lecture was Wednesday, the day before, and it was on democracy and the future of democracy in the Arab world. And here Saddam Hussein invades and disrupts my theory, at least partially. And what I can say is that there was total collapse once the Iraqi army controlled the country. And what happened is that the whole country came to a halt. Banks, shops, the private sector, hotels, restaurants, cars, everything came to a halt. And this is where the resistance, I would call civil disobedience and peaceful resistance, started by the Kuwaiti society as a reaction to the entire invasion. And that's when, in each Kuwaiti neighborhood, people were able to put together their life, take care of their medical needs, arrange their food needs, and be able. I mean, each of these neighborhoods looked like a commune, looked like an independent arrangement by itself, by which people will be supporting and helping each other and defying the Iraqis. And it took a lot of work to manage that, but it was managed. And at the same time, there was a military resistance started by a smaller portion of the Kuwaiti society. But the overall reaction was basically that of peaceful resistance and peaceful defiance.
Let me add, Terry, that even the young people and children in Kuwait participated in this spirit of voluntary work that spread among the people. Young people were carrying each other, wiping names of streets and numbers of streets to make it harder on the Iraqis to find or locate a certain house or a certain person. Schooling itself was starting to be organized from inside the houses in the different districts. So we were really trying to make our life as safe and as normal as possible under the occupation, at the same time send a strong and unconfused message to the occupier that we are really not dealing with the occupation. And for us, the teachers at the university, there was a strong argument going between ourselves whether to go and report to the Iraqi administration. We had a new Iraqi administration of the university that is armed. And we had a strong argument whether to try to go and report once the official summer holiday finishes or not. And maybe by this trying to protect as much as we can from our premises and from the institutions and the labs on the university campus.
What was that debate like among the university professors in deciding whether you should report to the new Iraqi officials at the university?
Part of us thought that if we go and report to the university, we may be able to convince them not to destroy, not to do anything to the labs, to the offices, to the computer equipment and everything. In the last few years, we've really spent a lot of money on the university campus, whether related to the buildings or to the facilities themselves. The other part of us said, no, we were not going to go and cooperate with the Iraqis, even if they destroy the university. I mean, they are destroying the whole country. And the university will not mean anything with a country completely destroyed. This argument was going on and on between us, back and forth. In the meanwhile, they would call us to pressure us, to intimidate us. Later on, this pressure increased and it reached to an armed pressure even to come and go to the university. They wanted to create a feeling of normalcy. They wanted to bring the Kuwaitis to work with them. But at the same time, they were going destroying. So we said, these people are not really serious about opening a university or let it function, so we are not going to go and cooperate with them. And finally, we decided by consensus in the last meeting I remember we attended, there were several of our colleagues at the university. We decided that no one will go to the university. The university was already destroyed. Several of the libraries were already looted and destroyed. So it was a painful decision for us, a painful argument, but we had to make our message.
You are both Palestinian Kuwaitis, yes?
Yes, we are.
Was there a split within the Palestinian community in Kuwait about how to respond to the invasion? And I ask that since so many Palestinians are now siding with Saddam Hussein.
Let me say the following. The Palestinian community in Kuwait and the Palestinian community in the Gulf and the Palestinian community in Saudi Arabia did not side with Saddam Hussein. And I definitely believe it's very important that this is made clear. And the reason they did not side with Saddam Hussein is that it was harder for Saddam Hussein to exploit to twist the facts and to exploit the emotions because they were seeing what was going on and they were more in touch with the events around them. Palestinians in Kuwait didn't take them much to see what the Iraqis were doing in the country. It didn't take them much to see that the peaceful protest by the Kuwaiti society was met with immediate executions and a lot of torture and widespread looting, which touched as well Palestinian shops and houses and property and places.
Were there divisive debates within your circle of friends and colleagues about what the appropriate response should be, how to behave?
Yes, there was debate. And one of the things I really ended up doing is be a go-between my Kuwaiti circles and my Palestinian circles.
What was the difference between those two circles?
Let me put it this way. For the Kuwaiti society, the invasion itself, and it's from day one, it was clear that the Iraqis were totally after the Kuwaitis, after the structure of the economy of the country, after the Kuwaiti members of the army, of the elite groups, of the opposition, of all the forces. They were after the Kuwaiti people immediately. What the Iraqis tried to do is leave the rest of the foreign communities on the side, leave the rest of the non-Kuwaiti communities. And in this, coming with slogans and of pan-Arab nationalism, etc., they tried to pacify the Palestinians. On roadblocks, they would try sometimes to make differentiation in treatment. And so what was important here is for the Palestinians to have a debate And that's what happened. They've had a debate regarding what was going on. And it didn't take much for the majority of the Palestinians to realize that the Iraqis intended to destroy Kuwait with all its population, whether it is Kuwaiti, Palestinian, Egyptian, Lebanese, American, whatever. I mean, this feeling later on of the Iraqis destroying the entire country really had its toll on the Palestinian community. And when I saw, I say, go between, basically is that there was an important debate in the community, because you can't but have such a debate, given the fact of the PLO stand, given the fact of the feelings among Palestinians and Jordanians in Jordan, given the facts about the just the general atmosphere of Saddam exploiting much of the Palestinian plight and exploiting Arab nationalism and exploiting Islam. We had to have this debate, and it was successful.
Tigrit, I wonder if you feel betrayed by the Palestinians who support Saddam Hussein.
I don't think I can call it betrayed. I may call it disappointed, maybe. However, when I speak with my friends, Palestinian friends all around, whether in Jordan, whether here in the States, whether it's things got mixed up. Palestinians feel very much betrayed by United States foreign policy, by the Western world generally, by not pushing forward to a peaceful resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. They feel very betrayed, and they are very self-righteous about their sufferings, as any people who suffer would feel, I think. And when I talk with them, they sort of got lost too, between being against foreign intervention in the area, in the Middle East, and specifically American intervention, and being against Saddam Hussein. Most of my friends would say, no way we could side with somebody like Saddam Hussein. I mean, he's the most oppressive dictatorship in this whole area. We can never side with someone like that. It's only that we feel sort of a breeze or a relief that somebody is challenging the West. Somebody is saying no one time to the West. We have never been able to say no to the Western world. And just for saying that, they feel sort of relieved, even though I would say it, part of it is being disillusioned and part of it is being really desperate. I mean, the Palestinians are very desperate. And I could see it. I mean, being a Kuwaiti myself, out of my country for 5 or 6 months is really painful enough. So let alone if this whole thing could drag, as in the case of the Palestinians, for 40 years. I do feel it because my family is still Palestinian. And I do know how it means and how it feels for them. That's why I wouldn't call it betrayal, because I think they feel betrayed themselves.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Dr. Shafiq Gabra and Tagreed Al-Qudsi Gabra. They were both professors at Kuwait University, and they escaped in October after the invasion. They're now living in exile in the United States. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dr. Shafiq Gabra and Tagreed Al-Qudsi Gabra. They were both professors at Kuwait University. They escaped from the country at the end of October. Shafiq is now a visiting professor of political science at William & Mary College. He's also the author of the book Palestinians in Kuwait, The Family and Politics of Survival. Tagreed is now lecturing for Citizens for a Free Kuwait. And I should mention that they are both married. Were you exposed to brutality after the occupation? Was there brutality that you witnessed, or were you victimized yourself?
There were certain difficult moments, on at least a couple of times, where the soldier was about to shoot, and this is very difficult. The soldiers on the checkpoints or wherever in Kuwait do have open orders to fire, and they can, for anything suspicious, if they find any paper, if they an argument, actually, a question not in the right, put not in the right way, whatever, can really cause brutality, can cause death, can cause execution. So we've had some encounters, and one of them actually was with the new dean, with the new Iraqi president of the university and the dean, as I was trying to salvage my furniture and my books from Kuwait University campus. He didn't like it, and I really had to answer to every item I had on the truck at gunpoint, and that was quite a surprise for me to see him really point a gun at me at the time, at checkpoints also. But the entire country of Kuwait came under a lot of brutality. I have friends and people I know who were executed. I have friends who were tortured. I've seen the marks on their bodies, severe torture. And there were people who were publicly executed. I mean, on daily basis, the time when I was there, basically August, most September, and most of October, on daily basis, you have 1 to 4 or 5 cases per day in such a small society like Kuwait, where the soldiers would bring a young Kuwaiti man and just shoot him in front of his parents, in front of his house. So it was really difficult to experience an occupation which really makes an onslaught on you from all directions, does not even give you a breath. And you add to all of that the constant looting of Kuwait. And that's, I mean, one of the worst brutalities one experienced is to see cars, convoys in the hundreds leaving Kuwait every night with refrigerators, radios, TVs, factory equipments. Kuwait buses have all been taken to Baghdad and are being used in Baghdad right now as transportation buses. School buses were all taken, books, libraries, everything that is movable have been taken. All the seashore area, beautiful residential areas on the sea of Kuwait, on the coast of Kuwait, most of the buildings there have been looted entirely.
If I may add, Terry,
yeah.
I think people sometimes are really astonished about our reaction, how strong our reaction to the Iraqi occupation, especially our fellow Arabs. And I keep discovering this when I'm going around and talking with them and with everybody around. I think the brutality, the severity of the occupation and its brutality in Kuwait had made our reaction so strong to it. We couldn't believe it. It was so painful for us to watch the whole country being looted bit by bit. I kept feeling that, you know, I'm at a point where I really don't feel what's private and what's public there. It all became one to me. Suddenly we had pictures, big pictures of Saddam Hussein around the country, all over the place. We had big statues for him all over the place. Our whole world was suddenly, as small as it is, was suddenly changing and being shattered for us. In addition to the torture and the rape and the killing of and the pillage of the country and its people, it made really a very strong impact on us and made our reaction as a result very strong, I would say.
Why are Arab Americans surprised at the strength of your reaction?
Because to them, I mean, this matter should still stay as an Arab matter. This matter should be solved among Arabs. And they get angry at us for allowing ourselves to be helped by non-Arabs, by people from the outside. And I respect this. And to me, it really is more respectable and more dignified even to be able to have an Arab solution to this whole problem. But unfortunately, and objectively speaking, the Arab world is so divided and so separated as never before even. And to add the Kuwaiti problem to the Palestinian problem, to the Lebanese problem, was out of the question for us as a Kuwaitis. We didn't want this whole thing to continue. And we knew we are a small country. We don't stand a chance of doing anything to the Iraqi forces or getting our country back if it weren't for other countries to help us in this matter. And our reaction is really very strong as a result of the oppression we were faced with. We know that this oppression has been going on and on for the Iraqi people themselves since Saddam Hussein has gained power in the country. But it was always, as we would say, out of our doorstep.
Tigrid, can you tell me how you escaped from Kuwait?
Well, fortunately, I have a little daughter who's 4 years old now, who was born here in the States when I was getting my PhD. So she qualifies as an American evacuee. I was permitted to accompany her. However, I was advised of disposing of all my Kuwaiti documents in Kuwait before I get to Iraq. Unfortunately, in Baghdad, they suspected that I was a Kuwaiti or married to a Kuwaiti, and they prevented me from continuing on the evacuation flight. I joined another group of like 60 women and children held in Baghdad for the same reason. Until I was able to identify some false identification papers and convince them that I wasn't Kuwaiti. And as a result, I took a minibus with another group to Amman, Jordan, and from there to the States.
So you both got out separately?
Yes, we did.
Shafiq, how did you get out?
Yes, well, I stayed behind for an extra month till the end of October. And literally, I did two things. The first, I had a very dear friend of mine who allowed me to borrow his passport. So I used his passport to leave Iraq, and I also had to provide a bribe to an Iraqi official whom I didn't meet. Someone in between arranged this for me. A friend of mine arranged this for me. And that person also helped process the papers inside the border point where I left out of Iraq into Amman, Jordan.
Tigreed, I know you feel very strongly about your country, Kuwait, but mm-hmm. Women don't have the vote in Kuwait, right?
No, they don't. Actually, Kuwait is really, in the Western sense, is an evolving democracy. So many things were coming to us on the way, so many things we were working for. So these things were coming on the way.
Do you feel any resentment at all when you read about the people in the royal family of Kuwait who were living at really high-priced hotels and spending their nights at Egyptian discos? We've all been seeing articles about that in the American press.
Terry, I mean, we can take this in two directions.
Yeah.
The first one is that Kuwait was a country which was all built on sharing. And there was a lot of sharing between the ruling elite and the rest of the society of Kuwait. Wealth was not really used in a bad way. It was mostly used to build a modern country, one of the best welfare systems in the Middle East. One of the highest per capita incomes in the world. It was used to make schools, to build modern highways and roads, to create a population which was before 1950, 80% illiterate, 90% illiterate. Now it has one of the high literacy rates in the Arab world. So much of that wealth was really used intelligently and productively. Now, to say that there are individuals who have done certain behavior, given a bad image, I would say that this is exactly what happens in every society. Every society, when it is involved in such a situation of exile, you're going to have different behaviors by different people. But the population of Kuwait at large can speak for themselves. So to really pinpoint one dancing or 10 or 20 in a disco in Cairo or elsewhere is really something the media would be interested in, but it does not represent but a fraction of the Kuwaiti society. So,
Do you want to return to Kuwait when the war is over?
Yes, I do want to return to Kuwait because I want to be part of the rebuilding of the country, and in particularly of Kuwait University. This is something I feel I ought to do, and it is important for me to be part of it.
Shafiq Gabra and Tigreed Al-Qudsi Gabra are professors from Kuwait University who are now living in exile in Virginia, where Shafiq is teaching political science at William & Mary College, and Tigreed is working with Citizens for a Free Kuwait. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tom Friedman has said that when it comes to discussing the Middle East, people go temporarily insane. But his lucid reporting on the area has won him two Pulitzers and a National Book Award. Friedman is a reporter for the New York Times and the author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. Coming up on Fresh Air, Tom Friedman on the Gulf War.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush, on the final stop in his one-day tour of southern military bases, encouraged families with troops in Saudi Arabia to stay strong. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports from Fort Stewart, Georgia.
About 18,000 soldiers left Fort Stewart for the Gulf back in August. President Bush told their families he knows they're making great sacrifices, and he promised that the U.S. will win the Gulf War.
We will have taught a dangerous dictator and any tyrant tempted to follow in his footsteps that the U.S. has a new credibility and that what we say goes.
Mr. Bush said a ground war with Iraq will only begin if necessary and when the U.S. decides the time is right.
We will conduct this conflict on our terms, on our timetable, not on Saddam Hussein's timetable.
I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president at Fort Stewart, Georgia.
U.S. officials confirmed today that an AC-130H gunship went down yesterday in Kuwait. All 14 crewmen in the aircraft are listed as missing in action. Meanwhile, the BBC has reported that Iraqi radio says that Allied prisoners held in Iraq will be treated as war criminals because it says that they fired on innocent women and children with machine guns. The State Department and the Soviet Foreign Ministry each deny today that a deal has been struck to gain continued Soviet support for the war against Iraq. Barry Schweid has more from the State Department.
Margaret Tutwiler, the State Department spokeswoman, called the reports absolutely, completely, and totally untrue. She said there will not be any deal. It's simply without foundation. Earlier in Moscow, Vitaly Churkin, the spokesman for the Soviet Foreign Ministry, said no deal was raised or discussed during Foreign Minister Alexander Bezmertnik's talks this week in Washington. The meetings with Secretary of State James Baker ended with a statement in which the Soviets reaffirmed their support for the liberation of Kuwait. During the talks, it was learned, Bezmertnik pledged Soviet forces not based in the Baltics would be withdrawn. Since then, there has been little U.S. criticism of Soviet actions in the Baltics. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Iran's deputy parliament speaker warned today that the country could fight alongside Iraq if Israel joins the Allied war effort against Iraq. Tehran Radio also reported that Iran sent a shipment of medicine and milk to Baghdad and opened a bank account for donations to Iraq. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 6 points to close at 2,730.69 on volume of some 247 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-2 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Fighting continued today in southern Lebanon between Palestinian guerrillas and Israeli forces. A Christian television station in Beirut called the fighting the new front in the Gulf War. Palestinians have not directly linked the clashes to the Persian Gulf War, but some factions have threatened to escalate attacks against Israeli targets to retaliate for the Allied offensive against Iraq. Baghdad Radio has now formally announced that the Iraqi forces, which captured the Saudi border town of Kafji earlier this week, have pulled out. And the Iraqi state radio has accused Allied air forces of deliberately killing civilians in raids on Iraq. Gerald Butt in Nicosia has been monitoring Baghdad Radio.
For 2 days, Baghdad Radio could talk of almost nothing else other than the capture of Kafji. The ground offensive was hailed as a glorious Iraqi victory. Then, mysteriously, 26 hours passed without any mention in military communiques of what was happening in the town. The silence was finally broken today by one brief sentence on Baghdad radio. The army units, it said, which had captured Khafji, had withdrawn. There was no explanation. The radio also accused Allied air forces of deliberately bombing civilian targets in Iraq. Therefore, the radio said, Allied pilots, including those now held in Baghdad, should be treated as war criminals, not as servicemen who observed military codes of morality. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
In Washington, the government announced today that the nation's unemployment rate grew from 6.1% to 6.2% last month. The Labor Department says that the number of people out of work in the country moved up to 7.7 million last month, continuing a trend that began in June. And construction spending was off 0.5% in December, continuing a downward trend. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman says he's learned from experience that a Jew who wants to make a career working in the Middle East will always be a lonely man. He will never be fully accepted or trusted by the Arabs, and he will never be fully accepted or trusted by the Jews. While reporting from the Middle East, Friedman found that if you have any credibility, everyone wants to own you, and if they can't own you, they want to destroy you. But Friedman says he's continuing to try to bear witness and think independently. Friedman has reported from Lebanon and Israel for the New York Times and won two Pulitzers for his work. He's also the author of the best-selling book, From Beirut to Jerusalem. I spoke with Tom Friedman earlier today about the war. I asked him if his emotions and his politics were at odds.
I feel that I'm an everyman when I approach this war, in the sense that I'm deeply ambivalent about it. And I've always felt since the beginning of this war that the ambivalence in this war isn't like half of Americans are against it and half are for it, but that half of each of us is for it and half of each of us is against it. On the one hand, I identify very deeply with the idea of the United States stopping a ruthless dictator armed with weapons of mass destruction, which can, to begin with, threaten people in the Middle East who share our values, and if not stopped, one day maybe even threaten us. But the other half of me is ambivalent because I have a hard time imagining myself or my friends or any fellow American dying to restore the Emir of Kuwait to his throne, dying to protect societies that don't allow women to drive, and trying to make the world safe for feudalism. And so I'm torn between those two impulses.
You're reporting from Washington now. You had spent years in Beirut and in Jerusalem. Is Washington the place you want to be now?
Oh, now you're really asking a tough question. for me, going from the Middle East to Washington as a reporter is like going from covering a street to covering a hall, and to going from covering a drama unfolding before your very eyes to covering a policy that's invisible. I mean, what is the you can't say I met the policy today; it wept on my shoulder, or I saw the policy bleeding outside the C Street entrance of the State Department. So there is a certain kind of bloodless quality, and I don't mean that I enjoy the blood. I mean an emotionless quality to Washington reporting that I find very frustrating. And the other thing that one finds frustrating in Washington is there are all these experts and government officials who, for whom the world out there is very neat. They have all their plans and their policy papers, and I have a much healthier respect for what I would call the wild earth. And maybe for the unpredictable nature of the Middle East.
So here you are in Washington now. From what angles are you trying to investigate the story of the war?
Well, really what I'm trying to think of right now, because I'm not a military correspondent and there's not much work these days for diplomatic correspondents, but what I'm trying to think about now is to answer really a very simple question. How will we know when we've won? What will be the ingredients of any victory? And a lot of the thrust of my reporting is to try to probe that with people. What will victory look like? How will we know when we've won?
Tom Friedman is my guest, reporter for the New York Times. He reported from Lebanon and from Israel for many years, and he's the author of the best-selling book, From Beirut to Jerusalem. Whether linkage is a part of our policy or not, it's impossible to talk to anyone in the Middle East, Arab or Israeli, without Israel-Arab relations and Israeli-Palestinian relations coming up. I'd like you to help us sort through some of the reasons why and some of the reasons for the deep distrust between Arabs and Israelis in the Middle East.
Well, let me turn your question around slightly and try to answer a question that really has been posed to me quite frequently, and I hear officials not talking about, and that is, what will be the opportunities after this war for Arab-Israeli and Palestinian-Israeli negotiations? Will they be improved or will they not? And I think right now we see events pulling in two different directions. On the Israeli-Palestinian front, what I would say is that long after Israelis forget the chill that went down their spine when they heard the air raid sirens go off, and long after they forget the thud of the Scud missiles landing in Tel Aviv, they will remember the applause of the Palestinians. The applause of Palestinians at the rockets that Saddam Hussein was firing into Israel. And that is something that is going to fundamentally affect for a very long time Israeli attitudes towards the Palestinians and the whole peace process question. In the 2 years, 3 years really, previous to this war, enormous progress had been made on the part of the PLO and Palestinians in convincing Israelis that what they were out for was their own state. And the difference between them and Israelis should be where the border is, not over the question of existence. And we saw that with the Intifada. We saw that with Arafat's declaration in Geneva. I would say the Palestinian response to the Iraqi Scud attacks on Israel, the fact that not a single Palestinian leader of a local level or a national level has stood up and condemned those attacks, has wiped out everything positive that might have been achieved in the last 2 years. Now, the more positive side of that, if there is one, is the fact that Certainly, several Arab regimes—Saudi Arabia, the Gulf States, and whatnot, even Syria to some extent—are now aligned with the United States in a confrontation with another Arab state. They are effectively or tacitly in the same trench with the Israelis. You could watch on CNN many nights Scuds coming into Tel Aviv and Scuds coming into Dahran, Saudi Arabia. And it is at least conceivable in the minds of some that after this war, there will be certainly a greater willingness of some of these Arab states to entertain the idea of a peace agreement or a greater recognition of Israel. And that once the Israelis are reassured about some of their concerns from the surrounding Arab states, maybe they might feel more secure about making overtures to the Palestinians. I personally am rather dubious about this, and I'm not sure that what we're seeing in the Gulf War can necessarily be extrapolated to the peace process.
You know, we've spoken to on this program several Palestinians who live in America or who live in the occupied territories. And when I ask about this cheering for the Scud missiles, what I'm told is, well, you know, what do you expect to happen? Palestinians in the occupied territories are living virtually under house arrest with a 24-hour curfew. Palestinians have suffered many deaths and even more arrests during the three-year intifada. What kind of response would you expect them to have?
Well, that reminds me of the line out of West Side Story where the Sharks and the Jets say to Officer Krupke, we're depraved on account of we're deprived. At what point do people begin to take a moral stand? What I would say to that is that, look, there are certain power realities in the Middle East, okay? And the reality of the Israeli-Palestinian balance of power is that the balance of power is far greater in Israel's favor. Now, given that reality, you can do, if you're Palestinians, it seems to be one of two things. You can confront that power reality with a superior power, or you can resign yourself to that superior power and try to deal with it diplomatically. But what I see the Palestinians doing is not being able to muster enough power to change Israel's behavior, and at the same time not being ready to state diplomatically what might be required to bring the Israelis along. This is not a charity game out there. I mean, no one's going to give the Palestinians anything because they've been deprived of something. It's not in the nature of the neighborhood. There was no charity for the Jews. There'll be none for the Palestinians.
My guest is New York Times reporter Tom Friedman. He's the author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. More with Friedman after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is my guest, reporter for the New York Times. He was for many years stationed in Lebanon, then in Jerusalem, and he's the author of the best-selling book From Beirut to Jerusalem. Just a couple of days ago, Sari Nasebe was arrested. He lives in the occupied territories. He's a Palestinian. And he was arrested for allegedly passing on locations of Scud missile strikes to Iraqis. Now, he's generally considered among the most eloquent voices in the Palestinian peace process, a moderate voice. You spoke very highly of him in Beirut to Jerusalem. You described him as having incredible insight and honesty. I wonder what your reaction was to his arrest.
I think it's outrageous. I know Sari Nusaybe, and without even knowing any of the facts of this case, I'd be ready to state categorically that the idea that he is somehow spying for the Iraqis is utterly ludicrous. I think the fact that he has been put under administrative detention, in which the Israelis don't then have to bring him to trial, in other words, don't have to introduce any evidence at all against him, but can simply say, we are arresting him for these reasons, we're locking him up for 6 months, and under these conditions, shows how little evidence they actually have against him. I think what they are afraid of is precisely that someone like Sari will break this wall of silence that Palestinians have imposed on themselves in terms of condemning the Iraqi Scud attacks on Israel, that he will step out, speak out against these attacks, and serve as the forerunner of some kind of future Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And I think the arrest of Sari, who's probably the most articulate and leading Palestinian advocate for a two-state solution, Israeli-Palestinian state, based on mutual recognition. His arrest, I think, is very revealing and very sad.
The PLO is in the Iraqi camp ostensibly because of how they were, this is the way Palestinians describe it, that the Palestinians are in the Iraqi camp ostensibly because of how they were sold out by the United States and Israel after Arafat agreed to recognize Israel's right to exist and negotiate. And then Secretary of State George Shultz authorized dialogue with the PLO, and it fell apart. And many people have said Arafat was kind of humiliated for his agreement to recognize Israel. Does that sound like a reasonable explanation to you? Is that the way you understand it?
Sounds really like nonsense to me. Let's go back to the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. Why was it important? What was sort of different and unique about it? Why did it capture the imagination even of Israelis in the beginning? It's because the Palestinians, through the Intifada, introduced really a new method and a new message vis-a-vis the Israelis. The new method was relatively non-lethal mass civil disobedience, the use of stones and civil disobedience as opposed to terrorism, hijacking, guerrilla warfare, call it whatever you will. In other words, they really tried to make life miserable for the Israelis, but not necessarily dangerous. That was at least the theoretical approach. And I'm not saying that they didn't engage in more serious violence, but I'm saying that was the underlying theory. Now, at the same time, they combined that with a new message, and the new message was no longer, when it comes to the question of recognizing Israel, saying, well, yes, no, maybe, and speaking out of both sides of their mouths, but with Arafat explicitly recognizing Israel at his press conference in Geneva in December 1988. Now, what the Palestinians didn't realize is that with those two initiatives, they were at stage one in their effort to achieve a Palestinian state in this new method and new message. But they had to get to stage 10. You can't just, in one press conference in Geneva, insert the word Israel in one sentence and expect that Israelis are going to roll over and say, oh, my God, after 20 years, I mean, Arafat said the word Israel one time in one sentence. Please, here, Yasser, take the West Bank and half of Jerusalem, too. It's got to be a process. It's something you've got to build on. It's something you've got to cultivate. Now, do the Palestinians have reason to complain that even what Arafat did was not even met with a parallel gesture from the Israeli government? Absolutely. But then the response, it seems to me, should not be to say, okay, well, we tried, we said it one time, now we're taking our ball and going home because this isn't fair. There's no fairness, okay? Then you've got to redouble your efforts. You've got to redouble your methods of civil disobedience, and you've got to redouble your message of recognizing Israel. And by slipping the word Israel one time in one sentence into Geneva, just ain't going to do it.
My guest is New York Times reporter Tom Friedman. He's the author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. More with Friedman in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Information about the war in the Persian Gulf from the Pentagon and from Saudi Arabia. Also tonight from Iraqi radio. And a new assessment, albeit an anecdotal one, from Jordan. An assessment of the bombing damage in Baghdad, said to be not as bad as previously thought. NPR's John Madison has the second part in a series about racism in America. Tonight, a look at integrated housing, including this point made by South African students in Chicago who say the conditions in their home country, in some cases, could be better than housing conditions for minorities in this country. And report about Soviet soldiers patrolling the streets of Moscow.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tom Friedman is my guest, reporter for the New York Times, and author of the best-selling book, From Beirut to Jerusalem. And he reported for many years from both cities for the New York Times. He's now based in Washington, D.C. You're thinking a lot about what peace might look like in the Middle East after the war is over. Do you have any scenarios you'd like to suggest to us about what you'd like to see happen?
Well, let me tell you my overarching feeling is that we should be limiting our objectives right now and not widening them. I've always believed that this war is about stopping Saddam Hussein. Okay, this is about catching a thief, essentially. If you've seen the movie The Godfather, then you can understand what this war is about. Saddam Hussein came to the Kuwaitis and made them an offer they couldn't refuse. And they refused. So he engaged in the international equivalent of a kneecapping. He engaged in the world's biggest bank job. And having done that, he called up the Saudis and said to King Fahad, King Fahad, you live in such a beautiful house. You have so many beautiful oil wells in your backyard. It would be a shame if there were a fire here. But you know what? It's your lucky day, because I, Saddam Hussein, am selling fire insurance. And for only $2 billion a month, I will ensure there will be no fire here. And King Fahad called George Bush and said, look, I got this mafioso down the street. He's trying to sell me fire insurance, and he's crazy, and he likes to play with matches. And George Bush said, look, we will be the cops. Don't buy the insurance. So this is not about a new world order. In the Middle East. This is about law and order, okay? I get very frightened when I hear the president talking about healing the wounds of the Middle East, establishing a new order. Look, this is an old part of the world. It's very old clay. You can't build a new order out of it, okay? The people out there haven't had therapy, okay? That everyone's, you know, suddenly ready to the lamb to lie down with the lion. So what I say is, let's do the job we set out to do, reestablish some law and order, and then let's get out and come home.
Are you afraid that we won't get out and come home afterwards?
Yeah, I am afraid of that.
What does that picture look like?
Well, you know, one of the things I learned in covering the Israeli invasion of Lebanon is that it's a lot easier for a superior military force to enter into a country than it is to get out of that country and still preserve your gains. I mean, the Israelis invaded Lebanon in the summer of 82. They cut through the PLO and the Lebanese like a hot knife through butter. But when they wanted to get out and still preserve the gains that they had made through their military might, it became much more difficult. What I worry about is that we do engage in a ground war and we do liberate Kuwait. And then what happens if the Iraqis still send Scud missiles into Israel? Or they still shell us from Basra, from the Iraqi side of the border? Do we then occupy Basra? And if we occupy Basra and they shell us from Baghdad? So I'm very worried about this sort of perpetual war of attrition.
Say we did what you wanted. You know, we went in, we restored the status quo and came home. Well, the status quo is incredible instability in a lot of ways in the Middle East. And the status quo is filled with deep hostilities. So you're kind of back where you started in a lot of ways, with the exception that, you know, Iraq is a lot weaker and maybe Saddam Hussein is out of power.
I'm afraid, Terry, in my mind, that's about all we can hope for. We can hope for a reasonably stable balance of power in which neither side or none of the sides will feel it has an incentive, militarily speaking, to attack the other. The idea of arms control in the Middle East, I was reading about that this morning, strikes me as insane. I mean, the idea that you could have arms control in the Middle East, I mean, you know, it's like arms control in the Wild West. I mean, who's going to trust anybody here? How can you have arms control between Israel and Syria when Syria is much worried about Iraq and Turkey as it is about Israel? I mean, there are just too many variables here. You got too many unstable chemicals. I have very, very low expectations for this part of the world. All I hope for is stable balances of power in this wilderness of tigers so that none of the tigers will have an incentive to devour anyone else. But healing, therapy, that we all learn to love and live with each other, it just isn't in the nature of the neighborhood.
Tom Friedman, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Friedman is a reporter for The New York Times and author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Before the war started, Roger Fisher of the Harvard Negotiation Project said we should negotiate with Saddam Hussein. On the next Fresh Air, Fisher returns to say it's not too late to stop shooting and start talking. Also, journalist Ron Brownstein on politicians who use celebrities to win votes. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
confusion over Kafji.
The story in this